When you're presented with an issue, there are pretty much two ways to confront it. You can either go with your head or your heart. First requires a study of things like facts to come to a positive, productive decision. The second rests pretty much on passions, beliefs, which, you know, might make you feel good, but most likely will fail to respond as you need to. The next guest with his new book takes American economic history, dissects how it was responded and reacted to, which I think shatters a lot of false beliefs, clears the way for facts and realities, thereby creating a much more solid path to solutions for what we are certainly seeing in our economic world in the here and now. His book, co-authored with Donald Boudreau, is The Triumph of Economic Freedom, Debunking the Seven Great Myths of American Capitalism. He's a former member of the U.S. House and Senate. And then in the Senate, he chaired the Senate Banking Committee. Today, he's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. It is an honor to welcome Senator Phil Graham to the show. How are you today, sir?
I'm good. Thank you, Chris. And thank you for the introduction to the book.
Well, thank you for writing it because, well, first and foremost, I'm a fanatic for history. And when it's used in its proper way to present reality and how it can transpose yesterday into value of today, I think that's what you have done with this book.
Well, it has struck me over my lifetime as a college professor, and I was an economist, and as a congressman and a senator, and as an investment banker and in private equity, that people's views are very much colored by their own experience and their interpretation of the information they have. If you ask, for example, the two leaders of the Senate what they believe, you would conclude that Schumer is a modern-day liberal and that the Republican leader is a modern-day conservative. But if you ask them what happened during the Industrial Revolution to working people, or was progressive era regulation successful? What caused the Great Depression? Was American manufacturing hollowed out after World War II by international trade? What caused the financial crisis? What is the underlying cause of income inequality, and how big is it? And what is the cause of poverty? You would get totally different answers to those questions. They would have totally different interpretation of what the facts are. So the book aims at looking at five historical periods that normally, for most people, defines the world as they see it. And then the two modern issues that are current, inequality and poverty. And we look at each of those areas, and we start out by just setting out what the agreed-upon facts are, and then what we present as the myth. And we give it full coverage, and then we set about debunking that myth. And the idea being that if you change people's knowledge base, you affect their opinions. And so that's what the book is about.
And maybe I'm oversimplifying it here, but because capitalism has become an evil word to so many people, it's obviously in the subtitle of your book, Debunking the Seven Great Myths of American Capitalism, and social programs, you hear the lights light up and the angels start singing if you mention those. But if you describe them too as, instead of saying capitalism, an opportunity to learn, to achieve, to grow, to provide for yourself, your family, even your next generation. And if you describe social programs as a way to not have to work and just to receive for doing nothing, I tend to think
taken care of.
I tend to think opinions of those two aspects of economics would probably change with a lot of people.
No, I think that's right. And the my great frustration in my period of public service for almost a quarter of a century was watching government trying to help people, but almost always in the process destroying their ability to help themselves. And I once tried to explain to my mama that we were lucky when I was growing up that we didn't have welfare. And my mother's response was, well, I would have never taken it. And I, of course, I explained to my mother, everybody would have been taking it, and people would have mocked you for not taking it. The point is, my life would be very different. And I wonder how many people out there caught up in a failing education system and a welfare system that destroys incentives have ability and could contribute to this country and have meaningful lives that we don't reach with the message of opportunity and freedom. And that's really what the book is trying to do.
I want to look at one chapter in particular, the financial crisis myth, deregulation caused the financial crisis. Now, again, if you're not well-versed of understanding of even basic economics and history combined, you would think, okay, less regulation or deregulation, that's going to be a good thing because there'll be more freedom. Is that always going to be true?
Well, deregulation is not elimination of the rule of law and protection against fraud and the enforcement of contracts. But what caused the financial crisis was we had a concerted government policy to encourage homeownership, whereby the government, through Freddie and Fannie, drove down credit standards to such an degree that by the time the wheels came off, 50% of the new loans that were being made were subprime to people who could not make the payments. And when the increase in housing prices ended and people had to start making these payments instead of just refinancing, then you had a wholesale collapse, and that affected every financial institution in the world. So the point of the chapter is government policy produced the financial crisis, the subprime crisis, it should be called. There was no government regulation for the previous 20 years of financial systems in terms of safety and soundness. In fact, there were four or five bills that had increased regulation. But the point is, we force regulators to choose between safety and soundness and the government's housing goals. And there's no evidence that if we'd had more regulators or if they'd had more power, that they would have chosen differently. So this is a case where government created a problem through its policies and then blamed the private sector for it. And that's the point of the chapter.
Running out of time with Senator Phil Graham, his book, The Triumph of Economic Freedom, Debunking the Seven Great Myths of American Capitalism, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. And for you listening, when you read Senator Graham's book, you also see as the timeline moves forward in the points of history where he dissects and references, you can see the growth of government involvement in economic policies and programs. You also learn, certainly before the end, but definitely by the end of the Triumph of Economic Freedom, how the more government is involved, I hark back to the statement by Ronald Reagan, the most frightful thing you can hear is, hello, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And that's one of the lessons you get. And I think, too, you sum it up with a great quote from economist David McCord Wright, growth comes through change and causes change. So is that the crux of everything? People just don't want things to change.
Well, there's an element of that. growth has created destruction. When the automobile came, it destroyed the buggy industry, the breeding and housing of horses. Any new way of doing things destroys old ways. And America has had what is called in the world this the advantage that we have, the American premium, because we have allowed the market to work. We have allowed creative destruction to work because we wanted the creation. We wanted the new product. We wanted to move to bigger and better things. But there always will be a process whereby there will be those who don't want change. And, for example, in the chapter on the Industrial Revolution, many of the things that we have read about the Industrial Revolution were written by people who owned land in Great Britain, the landed gentry who were losers from the Industrial Revolution, because all of their workers, or many of them, moved to the cities in search of opportunity and freedom. So they write all these stories about how terrible things were in the factories. And yet, in an 80-year period, mankind had the greatest increase in the well-being of ordinary people in the history of the world. From the fall of the Roman Empire until about 1800, there was very little growth in the world. And then all of a sudden, with the economic enlightenment, the idea that people own their own labor and the right to the benefits of their own savings and investment, you had this revolutionary change where ordinary people got to make decisions and got to benefit from their effort. They didn't have to share their fruits of their labor with the king or the guild or the church or the village. And when that happened, you had an explosion of growth and real wages, lifespan, any measure of well-being, mortality, morbidity. By every respect, the Industrial Revolution was one of the great events in the history of mankind. And yet, we have this nostalgia for pre-industrial growth, this idea that somehow people moving from the rural areas to the cities to work in factories was so terrible. Well, it's terrible only because with the prosperity that came from the Industrial Revolution, looking backwards, we see how poor people were then compared to now. But before the Industrial Revolution, the idea that poverty or child labor could have ever been eliminated was unthinkable. But what made it thinkable was the Industrial Revolution. And in America, you had this obsession with roughly 4,600 millionaires that had been created by the Industrial Revolution in America. And yet, 70 million people had seen their wages and their well-being and their lifespan grow by biblical proportions. But in interpreting the history, too much of the focus is on the fact that somebody got rich. They got rich by making the rest of the people richer. It's the question I often ask and ask in the book. Are you poor because Warren Buffett is rich? Mm-hmm. We're richer. He invested our money. He changed the way money was invested. The growth in our retirement plans much of that he benefited. It was benefit he shared, and he's benefited more making that money than he'll ever benefit giving it away, or the government will ever cause benefit by taking it and spending it.
It is a fantastic book that is going to educate you, inform you, and give you the understanding you need to when you look at something again in the here and now. Let's go with trade, for example. We see claims being made about American manufacturing and isolationism, protectionism, whatever you want to call it. And what Senator Graham writes in The Triumph of Economic Freedom runs counter to a lot of the claims that you're hearing about that and many other elements. That's again, going back to the root, and one of the purposes of history is to learn from it to make it better than rather than repeating a failure that was a part of it. The book, The Triumph of Economic Freedom, debunking the seven great myths of American capitalism. Senator Phil Graham, you have made so much easy for people to understand and learn with this book and to share as well, because, again, another part of the value of history, too, is to share the facts about it with as many people as you can, just like you have. And we appreciate you doing that, and thanks for being here today.
Well, listen, thank you very much for discussing it. The Bible says you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. But the problem is getting to know the truth. So whether we found it or not in the book is debatable, but the fact that we're looking for it is not debatable. And I think if you'll read this book, you'll understand our country better and what it has achieved. And while we hadn't gotten to heaven yet in America, we've come closer than any other people who've ever breathed the breath of life on this planet. And our country deserves credit for that.